G'day, and welcome to Follow the Money, the Australia Institute's podcast demystifying the big economic issues in Australia and putting them in plain English. I'm Ebony Bennett, Deputy Director at the Institute, and today we're privileged to bring you another guest from our Economics of a Pandemic webinar series, Health Minister Greg Hunt, in conversation with our Chief Economist Richard Dennis. The Minister discussed the reasons for Australia's clear success at handling the public health crisis, including the operation of the National Cabinet, as well as issues like the possibility of a trans-Tasman bubble with New Zealand.
Across Australia, we're all playing our part to stop the spread of coronavirus. I'm doing my part.
We all have a role to play. Employers, nurses, doctors, teachers, scientists.
And remember, 50% of the spread of COVID-19 virus comes from asymptomatic people. And without social distancing and other controls, each person passes it on to nearly three other people.
To put in place the necessary public health interventions to support our vulnerable populations, be they in long-term care facilities or be they in refugee camps, no one is safe until everyone is safe.
Hydroxychloroquine.
I'm taking it. Hydroxychloroquine. Right now, yeah. A couple of weeks ago, I started taking it because I think it's good. I've heard a lot of good stories.
Health authorities are planning to ramp up testing for COVID-19 to include people with even mild symptoms.
So we can actually get this test back in the same day, and our tests are really sensitive.
Right now, there's one thing all 8 billion of us on Earth wish for, a vaccine for COVID-19.
First human trial for a coronavirus vaccine set to begin next month in Australia.
As many Australians as possible to download the app to help our disease experts find anybody who might.
New South Wales Health is having technical issues that mean they cannot use the data from the app to help trace the contacts of an infected person, which is.
Stay home.
Stay home.
Stay home.
Stay home.
Stay home.
Stay home.
Stay home, please.
And due to some technical difficulties, the Minister joined the webinar a few minutes late, so we'll pick up from where he joined the conversation.
So thank you so much for joining us today. We were just talking about the huge success that Australia has had in terms of its public health response in response to the pandemic. But obviously that's had, you know, a huge impact on our society. The Guardian report is reporting today that we've got only 704 active cases and a tragic 99 deaths. And that compares to, for example, close to 90,000 deaths in the United States now and almost 35,000 deaths in the United Kingdom. And I just wondered if you could reflect as the minister, there were a lot of difficult decisions that had to be made very quickly and sometimes with imperfect information, I'm sure, to avoid those thousands of unnecessary deaths. And we've got a lot of commentators and some economists now kind of talking about the fact that perhaps we overreacted. I just wondered if you could start us off with your response to that.
Okay. Well, firstly, thank you. And thank you, to everybody for what you've been doing. I know there's a range of people from different backgrounds on this, but you have public health and you have epidemiology and you've got the science, and as well as having the economics community. So, the starting point is, of course, the counterfactual. And we can look at, countries we know incredibly well, the US, the UK, France, Italy, Spain, and many, many others. And they provide a counterfactual. But there is also a misinterpretation that's sometimes put on them because they have all taken enormous measures. Sometimes it's presumed that they're not taking significant measures. CityMapper does a great analysis of movement in, I think, about 50 major cities. At the same time as Australian movement was down in Sydney and Melbourne to 12 and 13% through April of its normal. In New York, in London, Milan, Barcelona, San Francisco, it was down to 5% or below. And I think in Milan and Barcelona, it was at 2 and 3% of normal. So they had massive, massive restrictions placed on them. But it was the time in the course of the disease progression where these things were put in place. And so that is absolutely the essential element as to when these steps were taken. in each of the countries relative to where the disease was. And so, the counterfactual is not, you know, New York or London. It's what would have happened if there was no action. That's the starting point. And so the predictions of, you know, between 50 and 150,000 lives lost, I think were absolutely right. That if you had a no action situation, then, you know, you would have headed towards a whole of population coverage. And if you had 15 million people, 1% of that in terms of human life is, you know, unthinkable and unspeakable. So stepping back, essentially, there are a series of factors in Australia. We set very early on the two pillars of containment and capacity. This is, you know, flattening the curve and lifting the ability of the hospitals to deal with the worst case. And the containment was built around the four elements of the border control, of which the most important decision was the China decision on the 1st of February. And you know, many of you are associated with universities, so you'll be well aware that that decision on the 1st of February was not matched by our competitors in the UK and Canada. And so there was a lot of upset amongst many parts of the economy, particularly the education and tourism sectors, saying, well, others aren't doing this. And our view at the time was, well, we think this is going to be absolutely serious, potentially globally catastrophic, but we're going to take these decisions. And what was interesting is we'd already had a large number of National Security Committee meetings after the 21st of January. So the PM chaired them, convened them, brought in the health experts, but brought in the whole national security apparatus. And so we weighed up the risks and then the responses, and then we set out the triggers. And when human-to-human contact was confirmed outside of Hubei, we acted there. At the same time, we were building our testing capability, and our biggest risk was a decrease in supply and an increase in demand for global tests. So we moved early to lock them in, and that was a constant fight through February, March, and April to get that testing capability. And the same with masks, and then we were also building towards the ventilator capacity. The third was the contact tracing to lift the capacity of the public health units across all of the states. And they've done a great job. They've done a really good job. And in Victoria, for example, they went from 25 public health unit members for tracing to 1,000. So they effectively established a disease detective workforce, you know, within a month. And the app comes into that. I think we're about 5.85 million as we speak, might be a tiny bit more. That's an additional element to the tracing, which other countries are now looking for our source code. And they're very, very keen to take up what Australia's done. Of the voluntary apps around the world, I think it's arguably the most successful so far. The fourth of the areas is the one which is, along with the border closures, had the most economic impact, is the social distancing and the business closures. And some would want a sort of stage four New Zealand style lockdown. Some would want a more laissez-faire Swedish approach. We chose what we thought would have the highest disease impact, but whilst maintaining manufacturing, mining and construction, for example. So we had a negative list of what wasn't allowed rather than a positive list of what would be allowed, particularly because we thought there would be massive unintended consequences in manufacturing, that if you close down a plastics manufacturer in Bayswater, who would know that four steps down the path that would mean that you wouldn't have hose pipes for ventilators in Perth. So we were very cautious about that. Then so all of those four things are the ones that we put in place, and they've been the essential defence mechanisms. At the same time, we've done the capacity building in primary health. There was a real risk in late March that the GP workforce could have been overwhelmed. Many GP practices were beginning to self-close or be very, very cautious about patients coming. They were looking at what was happening in Italy and Spain in particular, and they could see the impact on health workforce. So telehealth was a fundamental step. We've now hit 10 million telehealth consultations, and I think that will be a permanent change to the landscape.
That's encouraging.
Yeah, the aged care facilities. We've had, you know, two very significant tragedies, but we have over 2,700 aged care facilities, and we've had 27, I think, that may have had an infection, maybe 28, depends on one is confirmed from overnight. It was positive, now it's negative. So let's call it approximately 1%. And our biggest fears are Indigenous communities and aged care facilities. There hasn't been an infection in a remote Indigenous community, and it's approximately 27 or 1% of the aged care facilities that have had an infection, and of those, only 10 have actually had resident infections. And so that's an extraordinary outcome. And we provided a very significant supplement to keep aged care workers working because there was a fear that they would move. And then the last was the hospitals. And the hospitals, we set out for the training and the ventilator capacity. And we went from 2,200 ventilators to 7,500 capacity around the system. Now, we're down, as of this morning, to seven. People on ventilation around the country. So
that's certainly extraordinary. If I can just interrupt you there for just 1 second, and I'll just remind everyone that this is being recorded, which I should have done right at the beginning. But that is absolutely an extraordinary response, and obviously we can see the impact that that's had in the figures. Richard, I wondered if I might turn to you. Did you have a question for the minister?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I've got a couple of questions for you, but I guess the first one is, so the information available to you was available to different levels of government in the US, different levels of government in the UK, different levels of government around the world. You know, without wanting to comment specifically on another country, what do you think other countries have done wrong? Were they too slow to act, or did they not believe the advice? I mean, we clearly we stand out, and congratulations to you and to the states for doing what you've done. But what was the mistake that you think others made?
Yeah, well, I mean, there are other strong examples. Obviously, Taiwan, New Zealand has done really well. You know, New Zealand's figures are very, very comparable to ours. They're fractionally higher in case numbers and fatality rates across the nation. But, you know, for all intents and purposes, that's a few people. Taiwan is a standout. Taiwan obviously had the experience with SARS, and they were and they see things coming out of China that nobody else does. They, you know, their people are interlinked. Their human intelligence on the ground is very, very strong. So we essentially there was a very early series of meetings with the PM, Brendan Murphy, Paul Kelly, who's the Deputy Chief Medical Officer, and myself. And we talked about the degree of risk. And I think the thing that happened here, so I won't define what others didn't do, I'll define what did happen here, is that you had the national leader who took this as a deadly, serious, existential threat. And you can imagine the decision to close the borders with China, to stop travel at the very moment all the students were about to arrive, was a massive decision. But it was taken after 6 or 7 days of preparation of a what if, and then what do we do? And then on the day that it came, the decision was taken that day. So I think it was the speed of action and the structures through the National Security Committee as the operating committee, where we would make real-time decisions. But every decision was backed with, nothing was decided without papers going forward to it. So it meant that there had to be careful consideration in advance, but on-the-spot decision-making in a contested environment. And I think that was probably the most important part, and a commitment from, you know, the senior levels of government to honour and accept the medical advice. Those are the things that stood out here, that we were, you know, we gave primacy to the medical advice, and we had a structure which was designed for rapid decision making.
So, well, on that, I mean, obviously the economic and the social costs of those decisions were enormous. We've been told for decades in Australia that there's so many decisions we can't make because we can't harm the economy. And to be clear, I'm glad you made the decisions you did. Economists, I think they were good economic decisions in the long run, but the short-run economic costs are devastating. How come we're allowed to harm the economy in addressing an existential crisis like this, but when it comes to other things, whether it's climate change or welfare support, we've so often been told we, quote, can't afford to do something, or we can't make any decision that would have any impact on jobs or any impact. How as elected representatives do you choose which problems we can harm the economy for and which ones we can't?
Well, look, all the time you're making decisions, if you are, you know, from ending whaling a long, long time ago to now, you know, there are always decisions about what you can and you can't do. On this occasion, the answer was pretty simple, that there was a massive threat to life. There was a massive threat to the hospital's capacity to cope, and that all of that would have had a very significant and profound long-term economic impact as well. But ultimately, we prioritised health above all else. At the same time, we tried to minimise the economic consequences and to maximise the short-term interim supports. And they are interim supports. I know some would prefer to see them as permanent measures, but you have to work within the capacity of what is possible. Now, other equations are always a balancing act, and sometimes we'll disagree on mechanisms, as you know, as the many discussions you and I have had over the years. But
you'll come around.
Yeah, we both live in hope. But in any event, you know, on this occasion we had a combination of people and structures, and it is also worth remembering that, you know, for whatever criticisms of the WHO there have been, they ranked Australia as, you know, at the global forefront of pandemic preparedness 2 years ago. And so successive governments had actually prepared for this. There's been some talk about, you know, had we done scenarios, we'd actually, just on my watch, and this, I'm not relating this to me, these were things that were built into the system, done three major external pandemic exercises and five major internal pandemic exercises in just the last 3 years. And that's built into the Australian system. The National Incident Centre, the National Trauma Centre, the National Medical Stockpile, all of those were sort of schooled and ready to go in the event of something like this. And we scaled up the National Incident Centre very, very quickly with defence, with logistics personnel, with purchasing, with finance, with legal, as well as, you know, support for epidemiology from the medical community. So all of those things were able to be scaled up, and that was actually part of probably a 15-year program of Australia across successive governments putting that into place, and that was ready to go when this came into being. And then once that started, that constant flow of information from around the world and within Australia kept us very, very focused. You know, we could see what was going wrong in other parts of the world, and we could see examples of who was getting it right.
And I guess on that,
sorry,
how are we going for time, Minister? Can we hang on to you for a few more minutes?
Yeah, of course.
So I guess my next question is one again: how come we can solve some problems, not others? Do you think that human nature means that we do respond to an urgent crisis different to a long-term one, and or do you think, as you said, because we actually have structures in place for dealing with pandemics and a range of other sort of long-term crises, that the structures we have make it better? Is it inevitable that humans will kind of, you know, jump from the burning platform rather than, you know, walk away from the sun causing skin cancer? Or can we fix these sort of longer term, slower burn problems?
No, I mean, I've been, as you know, optimistic about the long term as well as the short term. Now, not everybody, I don't think there's any human inevitability to this, because you look at the different responses of different countries and we're in the fortunate few. Others are, you know, doing it much tougher. And that in part is government response. In part, it was, you know, we used our natural advantages of being an island and we shamelessly used it. And but anyway, having said that, one of the things that is likely to come out of this is the potential for the National Cabinet. And you say, well, what's different between the National Cabinet and COAG? COAG was very much a set piece movement. It was a bit like the trenches of the First World War. Everything was dug in and, you know, there were a few pre-agreed agreements. This is a much more fluid dynamic, where it really is the leaders and all of the pre-bureaucratic work has been stripped away, and they've all come in looking to solve things. And I'm pretty sure that across the board, every one of them is committed to trying to make that a new forum for genuine discussion, decision making, and agreement.
Just one last question.
Sorry, go, Richard.
We had Helen Clark on one of our webinars last week, and not only have we had National Cabinet with premiers and prime ministers, but obviously another prime minister joined recently from New Zealand. That's, you know, amazing new structure. Helen Clark suggested that perhaps an Australian-New Zealand bubble might allow for the flow of students in the not too distant future, and similarly foreign students from other countries, if they can quarantine, might be able to stay and study if they go through a quarantine. Can you just quickly talk about where you think we're going to wind up in the next 6 months in terms of travel and openness to the world? Obviously,
yeah,
starting with New Zealand, starting with the Pacific makes some sense, but, you know, it's a radical for any country to cut themselves off. I'm glad we did, but as health minister, where do you see this? And
yeah,
do you think groups of students, for example, might be the first in?
So both of those are not just possible, but they're planned. So the first is in terms of the New Zealand bubble. That would be at about the same time or following, not long after the state borders came down. You couldn't do it in Australia until the state borders are down. And we would want to see that. Each of the states is working through that. the Queensland Premier gave a guideline yesterday, which was perhaps a little later than anybody had presumed in terms of Queensland. We'll wait and see whether that happens a bit earlier. That's later than any discussions internally. But certainly I would imagine that a New Zealand bubble could be in place before the 1st of October, if not earlier. But I'm just working back now from Queensland states when they were talking about it yesterday. So that makes very good sense. The second thing is quarantine is a 500-year-old concept. It comes from the Italian for 40, meaning 40 days. And it's a well-established principle. And so it's something that we're going to take forward as a highly likely pathway. I don't see, Brendan doesn't see, PM doesn't see any rapid access to people coming through unfettered borders until we have a vaccine. We've had a bit of a discussion with CSL today, and that's, you know, their view on the global vaccines is that that's progressing. Having said that, we think the student quarantine, you know, mandatory quarantine, 14 days, self-paid, is a very real thing. And we're working with all of the universities and we're working with the states on that. And I see for skilled migration and for student international students, the 14-day quarantine program being something that will become an Australian feature. And we've talked about that publicly. There's no surprise in that. And we're working through and designing that right now.
Great. Thanks very much, Greg. I wonder if I might ask you a question. You were talking earlier about how National Cabinet works and what's different about that compared to COAG. And I think you described it as a space where the medical advice was given primacy, but that was also still a contested space. Obviously, huge decisions were being made there, and I can think of schools off the top of my head as an area that seems to have been very contested. But can you just put us in that room? What is it like to be making those kinds of huge decisions? And can you just reflect a little bit more on how that new structure works and the, you know, absent the baggage of COAG?
Well, I can and can't put you in because I'm not in the room. It is the premiers, the cabinet secretary, and Brendan for all of the health, and then for the economics, it might be the Reserve Bank governor or the secretary of the treasury that does the briefing. Anyway, having said that, I was very involved with the PM in the preparation for it. We look back to the 1919 pandemic and the fact that both in 1919 and during the Depression, there was a massive splintering of the Federation. And so the PM went in to COAG just over 2 months ago, very focused on this idea of preserving the primacy of the medical expert panel, which is the body of chief medical officers around the country, because there were differing views and the medical community was beginning to fracture a little bit. And also aware of that history, but faced with a potential crisis around mass gatherings in the middle of that meeting, he proposed on the spot in what will probably be the most important, public policy decision of his life, the formation of a national cabinet. And all of the chief ministers and premiers I know with a great sigh said, yes, let's do that. And then they've operated in that structure. Now, like every cabinet, people bring different positions. And so there were different positions on school, but they found a way through with the baselines. And what it's done is it's allowed people to operate in a consistent fashion. Victoria has now come on board with a time frame. My own boy will be back in 12 days and counting. And so these things are very, very important. Having said that, yes, people bring differing views to it, but the degree of consensus has been remarkable. And what I, the big history here is that compared with 1919, compared with, 1930 to 32, even compared with the Second World War, where there was a fracturing in the first two and a fraying in the third of the Federation, this is the one great, cataclysmic national event which has brought a consolidation of the Federation. And so the mechanism, all of the ministers prefer the fast-moving structure. We've done it at a ministerial level. And then, as I understand it, all of the leaders prefer it. And so what happens is that they go in, they will debate, and positions will evolve and move, and then there's a consensus at the end of it. Sometimes that will mean people can move at different paces, but the triggers and the structures are agreed. And that's what's been extraordinary. I think everybody in there says, well, I'm only in this job for a certain amount of time. I want to get stuff done, and I'm getting stuff done through this mechanism. That's what I'd call the breakthrough.
Do we have time to keep you for perhaps two questions from our audience?
No, of course.
Excellent, thank you. So the first one I'll go to is from Catherine Kelly. She asks, are we manufacturing all our own protective equipment in Australia, or is some still being imported? I wonder if you can speak to that begin with.
No, we're still importing significant amounts, but we've created significant Australian manufacturing capability. Ventilators, we're very fortunate because we've got ResMed and we've been able to consume or to order and consume Australian production only. Test kits, we are working on a potential Australian capacity, but there was no significant Australian capacity. That was my biggest risk in all of this. So we've had to continue bringing from overseas. Now, a lot of the world had broken supply lines. We kept our supply lines open, but every day we had our teams in industry and health sourcing from around the world, checking and ensuring that the lines were coming. And in masks, we have very significantly increased our domestic production capability. We put in place long-term orders, but we're still bringing from overseas because just the bulk of what required meant that we still need overseas, but we've now supplemented it with a much stronger domestic production capability.
And exactly how difficult is that in the middle of a global pandemic while so many other countries are, you know, obviously scrambling to do the same thing? What kinds of things come into play there with Australia being successful at securing those things?
So I guess the early example is in February, we scoured the country for mask production. We really only found one, which was Medcon, a small manufacturer outside of Shepparton. Within a week, we turned them into a medium-sized manufacturer, and within a month into a large manufacturer. We brought the army in, and the army worked around the clock, you know, going from one shift to three shifts. We had teams focus on procurement of supplies. We had equipment brought in, and they taught the army how to do things, and then they were providing the support on the ground. And then equally, we built contracts with other potential suppliers in Australia, and we did contracts through to the end of the year to justify the capital investment, and worked with the states, and we're also working with the private market to ensure that there are offtake agreements. So what we did was we established procurement units for all of our at-risk suppliers in the Department of Health and the Department of Industry. Department of Health more looking at overseas, where they had contestable processes, and we had the Department of Industry looking at the domestic production.
And if we've got time for one final question, we've got a whole range of people who... did you say you could take a couple more?
Sure.
Great. Thank you. We've got a whole range of people on here wondering about whether or not we can take this success of putting experts in a role of kind of primacy and that expert advice, as well as the consensus that we've been able to achieve around the pandemic, and apply it to a problem like climate change. I wonder if you can take us forward, or indeed, you know, to some of the planning that's happening now. And do you think we can take this new consensus and this value for expert advice with us?
Well, this is the Platonic ideal of the philosopher king. And and so, firstly, I think there's a very real market for the national cabinet. Now, I'll wait for the leaders to make their own determinations and decisions, but they've spoken widely about that structure. Secondly, we actually have tried to build strong support mechanisms, and I think the King Review into Emissions Reduction was published today by Grant King, one of the experts in the field, known to many of you. That is informing the next steps on that front. Now, I know there'll be plenty of debate in this audience, not about the reality of climate. That's, for me, been a 30-year belief, but about some of the mechanisms. Having said that, we're setting those targets, and we're continuing to beat the targets. Now, some will argue for a tax on electricity. Others will argue, as we've done, for a reverse auction mechanism, simply as the lowest cost means of finding abatement. And Richard and I have had long discussions and debates around this. I think there will continue to be a role for the experts, and we'll continue to draw on them. Now, I'll have one more, and then, in fact, I have to speak on another teleconference very shortly. I apologise.
No worries. I've got one from Melissa Sweet, who's a health journalist with Croaky, asking, around the world, prisoners are recognised as extremely vulnerable populations for coronavirus. What have you, as health minister, done to protect prisoners and to look after their families at such a worrying time?
Yeah, so right from February, we were very focused on what we call vulnerable populations. Obviously, the elderly and those in aged care and those in home care. Secondly, Indigenous Australia. But thirdly were prisons. And so we had a prison plan with all of the states and territories. Now, I'd have to check, but to the best of my knowledge, there have been no inmates around Australia that have been infected and diagnosed. So we really built a very clear walled garden around all three of those institutions. And so we did that. And then we had plans of what if a prison were infected. And so in each of those cases, we've had, touch wood so far, very effective outcomes. And one of the Australian successes has been the fact that there have been over a million training modules on infection control that have been done. And all of those things together have meant that, you know, people in whatever institution are very, very strongly taking responsibility for their own infection control management. So at this point, there are no known cases, to me at least, of prison infections. But, you know, that's a watching brief.
Thank you. Richard, anything else from you before we wrap up with the Minister?
No, I think we'll let him go. But thank you so much for your time today, Greg. Sorry about the technological problems at the beginning, and thanks for your flexibility at the end. And, please keep talking to your state colleagues and keep flattening that curve for us. Much appreciated. Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks to everybody. And I suspect the technological problems are probably mine. I mean, who would have thought that I'd be responsible for launching the best-selling app in Australian history? those that know me. But anyway, thanks to everybody. And we just keep going. Take care.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. And if people would like to hang around for another 5 minutes, Richard and I might just wrap up a little there and touch on a few other things. As an economist, Richard, obviously we've had a lot of our supporters interested in the government's response on climate change and how we might take things forward. Greg Hunt just mentioned the King review there, but we've been very critical at the Australia Institute of, a lot of the government's response to climate change. But what are we seeing at the moment in terms of things that are being put in place now, as well as the Grant King review, if you've got any further comments on that?
Look, I don't think you could say, and, you know, I say this to Greg, you know, I don't think Australia is leading the world in climate emission reductions in the way that we have with our response to COVID-19. We're reducing energy emissions in some sectors. We're having some success in some places, but Australia's emissions are rising. We got rid of a perfectly workable, effective carbon price. And of course, we, you know, want to massively increase our coal exports and our gas exports. It makes absolutely no sense. Now, Greg's a former climate change minister. The direct action policy he introduced was not as good as the one that that it replaced. But I don't think everyone realises that if direct action didn't pass, we would have literally had no climate policy. You know, I guess it's another conversation that perhaps we can have with him one day, whether he'd do it on air or not, who knows. But, you know, cabinet is about getting a whole bunch of people to agree on things. And what's fascinating for me, and I think what we should all appreciate, is that not only is the federal cabinet agreed with some massive changes in a very short period of time. I mean, closing borders, spending $200 billion, you name it. Not only did Cabinet do that, but Cabinet worked with the state premiers and we built national consensus around that. And I think as citizens, we should all be pretty proud of that. I think we should all be pretty pleased with that. But more importantly, I think we should all be pretty demanding and think, okay, so we can do that. We've been told for years that you can't solve big problems. We've been told for years that you can't solve a problem if you know it harms part of the economy. Well, we now know that that's all rubbish. So I think the fascinating issue, which time will tell, is how, if at all, did the bushfires over summer have an impact on the Prime Minister coming into this crisis. The Prime Minister was pilloried for ignoring evidence over summer. He was pilloried for trying to do it all by himself. And he was really having a bad time politically and from a personal and governance point of view. But in the lead up, sorry, in the aftermath of all that, we see an evidence-based response that's cohesive and broad. So, yeah, I don't think you could say the government's doing a good job on climate policy. I think they're a long, long way from that. It's a disaster. But I think we have seen a new approach to decision-making, one we've never suspected was even possible. The question is, how do we generalise that? How do we take this approach and move it on to another problem?
I will just say, for anyone who's interested in a little bit more on climate politics, there was, I think, Four Corners on last night on ABC, and I myself participated in the ABC's podcast Hot Mess, I think, which is available as a podcast and broadcast on Sunday mornings. I was talking about the role of the Minerals Council and the Business Council of Australia in damaging Australia's climate policy. So that's a long-standing interest of ours. But just to wrap us up, Richard, and I want to thank everyone who's stayed with us during the early technical difficulties that we had. And obviously we couldn't get to as many questions as we wanted to for the minister, but we do appreciate you all sticking with us. But I would just wanted to wrap up, Richard, going back to that initial question that I asked. So obviously we've got a huge number of commentators now talking about the fact that we just overreacted, and by the fact that we've got such small numbers now and the huge impact that it's had on the economy means that we made the wrong decision initially. What are some other things that we might be considering that would put that kind of question into a bit more context?
Look, you know, it's interesting. I must admit, I hadn't heard the minister make the point that he did this morning, and I think it's an important one. Look at America. It's, 90,000 deaths. But their 90,000 deaths didn't come because they did nothing. It's because what little they did happened too late. So in Australia, we can't just compare ourselves to America or to England. We have to compare ourselves to an even worse outcome, because the Americans have done something. The English have done something. They just didn't do enough, and they didn't do it fast enough. So, yeah, to those that say, you know, we should have let it rip, as an economist, first and foremost, I'd say, well, the purpose of the economy, the whole point of economic activity is to make us healthy and wealthy and hopefully wise, to be prosperous. Well, not only does this disease unconstrained kill enormous amounts of people, it makes a far larger group of people quite sick. And imagine living in New York. Imagine going to sleep at night, or trying to go to sleep at night, and being unable to go to sleep at night because every 5 minutes a siren taking one of your neighbours, one of your friends to hospital where they might die is keeping you awake all night. The trauma for the communities that have gone through this in London, in New York, in Northern Italy is enormous. So the idea that we can just multiply the number of dead people by an arbitrary amount of money and say, well, that's the cost, that's what we've saved, it's ridiculous. So I think Australia has acted early. That's a good lesson for everybody. We have put health of people
ahead. One that might apply to climate.
Well,
but this earlier is better.
We absolutely have to say, well, what are the lessons out of this? The lessons are we can do it, when we want to. When we want to do it, we can. And we've chosen to do it in relation to this crisis, and we've chosen not to do it in relation to a whole bunch of things: climate change, Indigenous disadvantage. It's a whole bunch of problems we just keep kicking into the long grass because we say they're hard, or to fix them will have some adverse impact on the economy. Well, as the minister said, getting rid of whaling was bad for the whaling part of the economy. Dealing with COVID-19 is devastating for the tourism and education industry. Well, you know what? Tackling climate change will be bad for the profits of people who sell coal and oil. It will be. The question is, what do we all want to do about that? And we've just shown that we can come together and act fast and act consistently. The democratic question going forward is, what other problems will we aim that at?
And I know I said that was my last question, but you've just made me think of something else. So we have been talking about, and then I'll wrap up for everyone who's still with us. We're seeing a lot of talk and the Minister for Energy pushing this idea of a gas-led recovery and a recovery that's underpinned by fossil fuels, which is obviously going to be terrible for the climate. But what are the economics of gas at the moment, let alone the climate impacts? And, you know, is that the way that we should be going?
Look, you know, the gas industry's been telling us they're the transition fuel for climate action for 30 years. And Australia's, you know, still burning enormous amounts of coal. Once upon a time, I think the gas industry could have played a constructive role. But because we've burnt so much coal in the last 30 years, because we've ignored science for so long, we've now put so much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere already. We've used up so much of the carbon budget that there's just not time to muck around with transition fuels like gas. Those days are over. So the atmosphere tells us it doesn't have enough room for gas emissions. And the economics says, look, renewables are just cheaper already. And if Australia spends tens of billions of dollars propping up the gas industry now and installing new infrastructure and new gas generators now, all that means is in 5 years' time, we'll have more expensive electricity than if we'd spent the same money on renewables. So we need to transition away from all fossil fuels as fast as we can. That's what the science says. And we should be building things that provide the cheapest energy we can. That's what the economics says. Luckily, the science and economics are telling us exactly the same thing. Just crack on and install a lot of renewables and a lot of storage and do a lot of work on energy efficiency. It's just people who own oil and gas that think we should sell oil and gas. Well, you know, Kodak thought we should still be using print in our cameras.
Thanks for that, Richard. And thank you very much to Greg Hunt for being our special guest today. We appreciate the time that he was able to make available to us.
Yep. Thanks, Greg.
Thanks, everyone.
This was recorded live on Tuesday, the 19th of May, 2020, and things may have changed since recording. You can check out the Australia Institute's Economics of a Pandemic webinar series at our website, tai.org.au/webinars. The next event is on Wednesday, the 27th of May, 2020, with Australian Greens leader Adam Bandt about a Green New Deal. For the latest health information, you can check health.gov.au or listen to the ABC's excellent CoronaCast podcast, which comes out daily. You can visit tai.org.au for all our latest research and content, and we're on Twitter at the Oz Institute with an AUS. My Twitter handle is Ebony_Bennett with a double N double T. Greg Hunt is at Greg Hunt MP, and Richard Dennis is at RDNS_TAI. This episode was produced by Jennifer Macy, and our theme music is by Jonathan McFeet from Pulse and Thrum. Stay at home if you can, please keep washing your hands, and as always, thanks for listening.